started Neiman, and that was quite a broad, challenging, if you like, idea to grasp and bring to market. So what we did is we narrowed it down, we focused on men's health, and then we focused on even narrower domains. Lucky enough to be aware of the issue from a relatively young age. And even though I was aware of the issue, because I didn't stay on top of it as well as I should have, I found myself with early onset of atherosclerosis in my early 40s. If you think about health outcomes and health equity and access, what it boils down to is...
So Claudia, I'm very excited about this discussion. I've been seeing your journey for a number of years now, and I always wanted to have this conversation together. Can you give me maybe an introduction about Neiman, and then we can start with a story about how you started entrepreneurship?
Sure. Thank you, Kyriakos. Likewise, thank you for the invitation, and really good to be speaking with you. So Neiman, I started Neiman in 2018. So we're going to be entering we're in our sixth year now. We'll be 6 years old this summer, which is simultaneously believe that it went by so quickly, but you know what kind of the journey feels like, a very long time and a very short time at the all together. So how we got here, Neiman is my third business. So I've now been an entrepreneur, if you like. I've either been starting a business, growing a business, or sometimes investing in a business for the best part of the last 17, 18 years. And the first inception behind this idea came to me after I had sold my first business. I was at the time quite burned out. I was both at the same time very proud and very pleased of what we had achieved. That journey of starting a business, taking it to profitability, scaling, and then exiting. And I had started my first company when I was 27 was hard. And I was looking to see what I was going to do next, what I wanted to commit for a very long time, a problem that I was really interested in. And naturally, human performance for me was very exciting. But also I could see that kind of how health and being were becoming a lot more secular, they were becoming a lot more connected, and how behaviors were really starting to change. This is now back in 2012. At the time, I didn't commit to the idea because I wasn't personally ready. The infrastructure and the regulatory landscape wasn't quite mature at the time to be able to execute an idea like Neiman. But crucially, I think expectations from a large enough member of the part of the population wasn't quite ready to engage with their health and their well-being the way that I want to do it. At scale, in a mainstream fashion, that would involve not just suggestions or tools for behavior modification, but would actually include medicine as well. So in 2018, my kind of personal, if you like, stars and also the world around aligned a little bit better. And I started the business with that kind of passion and vision to bring together medicine, diagnostics, access to experts, and then tools to help you help yourself. And I started Neiman, and that was quite a broad, challenging, if you like, idea to grasp and bring to market. So what we did is we narrowed it down. We focused on men's health, and then we focused on even narrower domains of health, men's health. And that's how we started in London and went to market in 2019. First, I approached the problem space differently. I took longer to figure out what I was going to build, how I was going to do it, where I was going to play. I took a different approach to fundraising, a lot more committed to raising more earlier than before, and worried less about certain things that I, you know, was worrying about as a first time entrepreneur, and then really focused on that end to end funnel that involved distribution and not just product, which is painful lessons I had.
I'll get into distribution in a bit. What was the first product like when you launched?
It was simple. It was, in our eyes, it's simple, right? So we focused on one of the areas of men's health that is often overlooked. It is really riddled with stigma, but it is also an area where the problem is undeniable. and yet the awareness around the solutions to that problem are also not very well understood, or at least they were not very well understood in 2019 when it went to market. And that was sexual health, sexual performance, and erectile dysfunction. That's where we began. And we followed that quickly with hair loss. Now, this may seem the kind of the challenge and the opportunity there is that these are pretty fundamental conditions affecting a man's health and well-being. What I mean by that, if you have issues with your erections, you could have a number of underlying health causes. You could have a number of areas that you need to understand better and you need to act on. And the lack of like satisfaction there can have a downstream effect that is really can be quite devastating in some cases, right? It affects relationships, it affects self-esteem. It is a real issue. Similarly, with hair loss and aesthetics, the typical, if you like, approach from medicine is it's not that it's a health problem. And actually, hair loss, you can't say it is a health problem, but hair loss is significant. If you are in your, whatever age actually you are, and you start losing your hair, it really affects the sense of who you are as a self. At the time, even though those solutions were really undeniable, you can't deny either of those things that you have them. They're not like invisible things you need to be diagnosed. The understanding around the solutions around both of those things was not what it could be. So you had that combination where there was a lot of, call it latent demand. People wanted to do something about those issues. People were not aware that they could have effective solutions that they could trust. Everybody knew, of course, of Viagra, but people thought of it as something different, something else, something perhaps for much older men, something that it wasn't really okay for you to do. And when it came to hair loss, again, a lot of the solutions that are safe, effective, that you can access, but you need clinical support, you need to engage with a doctor to be able to safely understand and get access to, were difficult to get hold of, difficult to understand, difficult to get hold of, and then difficult to find the right, if you like, fit between the medication and your need. And that was a perfect problem to apply a digital first approach, because the clinical risk is very manageable. The solution is contained. You only have a limited amount of available treatments to work with when it comes to at least pharmacological treatments, and you could execute across the whole awareness, brand building, and then onboarding and managing patients using a playbook that was readily applied in a whole bunch of other industries, but you could bring to bear in a space like health.
I remember when I was in the military, and when you're very young and people are losing hair, folks doing all these medicines and drugs that were pretty weird back in the day. And now that you're mentioning it, it came to my mind that all of those years, it was very weird. And people were going to great extents to find more information. And whereas in this case, it's very obvious. It's also blood-based and so on. That's very interesting. What about, when did you introduce blood analysis? Was this at the beginning or was it?
It wasn't. We did that about 2 years in. We started our first diagnostic product. And again, to go back to the previous point, the people would go to great lengths and they would also put themselves at risk at times. Counterfeit medication and it still is, and it was back then, a real issue. Or people used to order things from overseas online pharmacies that would send things across borders with no real oversight or no real understanding of what it is that they were getting themselves into. And as, if you like, tested and safe those drugs are, they're never without side effects. You should always use them within, of course, a clinical setting under the prescription supervision and ongoing care of a team that is you can rely on. And that's, again, is the big difference with what we're doing. To your next question, which was about the, remind me what we're just talking about.
Let's speak about the introduction of blood analysis. Yes. How did you make the decision as well? I think it's a big introduction into a new product. And also it requires a lot of testing and laboratories and all of that work. How did you make that decision?
For me, look, from the beginning, the pillars for the business were medicine and medication, diagnostics, access to experts, whether they're doctors, pharmacists, nutritionists, whatever the expert that you need for the specific issue, and then digital tools to help you help yourself. These were the pillars I always thought of when I was thinking about the business and what we're building. And diagnostics and a proactive approach to screening, for me, is fundamental to prevent disease, to understand your kind of personal baseline of where you are, and then to make informed decisions about your health. This comes from my view of the world. It comes from where I believe health and medicine is heading. It comes also from a personal experience, right? So I've been blessed with high cholesterol from a very young age, right? It runs in my family. I've been lucky enough to be aware of the issue from a relatively young age. And even though I was aware of the issue, because I didn't stay on top of it as well as I should have, because I, like everybody else, let life get in the way, didn't do my testing as frequently as I should have done, didn't make the right decisions when it came to treatment or intervention early enough, I found myself with early onset of atherosclerosis in my early 40s. When I say I find myself, again, I took a proactive approach. I requested to have more in-depth screening because I was familiar with the risk associated with that. And because of that, I worked with the right clinical professional as well, and I went on statins sooner than I would have otherwise gone. And now the trajectory and the risk profile that I have is a lot lower than what it would have been had I not actually done anything about this issue or relied on traditional guidelines of when a man like me who doesn't smoke, exercises regularly, eats well, theoretically should have been looking into his cardiovascular health or his lipid profile or everything else. So I think it's absolutely fundamental for clinical reasons. The other thing that I think diagnostics does is it kind of modifies behavior by default, in a sense, when you know you're going to have a set of markers that you're going to be looking to work with. You will actually work better to improve them. And I think it is one of the areas that, especially in the UK, we're not as the public health system, but even the private health system in some cases, are not as proactive as they should be.
Yeah. It's when I contacted you to do the podcast, I also bought the testosterone test, the blood analysis. And actually, it was so much more convenient than what I expected.
Okay. That's great to hear.
Yeah. So I heard that if you do a shower before and then the blood circulates easier. So I did the test and it was super easy. And in comparison with doing my test, usually I would need to go to a doctor, take their prescription, and then go and find and do a blood analysis. So it would take ages for me to be doing that. And so I think the ease of access is very interesting here.
I'm really glad to hear that you had that experience. And look, a lot of what we do is, if you think about health outcomes and health equity and access, what it boils down to is cost, time, and then that friction, if you like, and that right threshold between motivation, energy, and then hurdles that you need to overcome to do something, right? I believe most people have a general sense roughly of what it is that they need to be doing. The reason they don't do it, if you take out a lot of the, if you like, more deep psychological or social barriers that inhibit people from taking action to their health, are that, again, life gets in the way, or as building products, the moment you introduce friction into something, you drastically reduce the probability that it's going to happen. So if you put motivation and friction on those two axes, the easier that you can do something, the higher the likelihood that it's going to happen. And then, of course, the more you reduce cost, the more, again, you're going to increase the population that can access those things. And with diagnostics, remote diagnostics, you also remove the geography, which is a massive factor, right? We're lucky enough here in San Francisco. I'm doing this interview from our office in London. We're 5 minutes away from world-class healthcare. you drive 2 hours out of London and it's just completely different. And for a lot of people to come into central London to do something like this, it's just such a big decision. And a lot of them will never actually get it done. So taking the test at home completely transforms that experience for them.
Considering that, how did the product change over time to accommodate for that? How was the V1, let's say, of the blood analysis versus the what is today?
It was embarrassing when we started. It was when we started also, of course, there was a little bit of disruption. If you remember around 2020 with access to, we went through all that craziness. In fact, that accelerated a lot of the screening and a lot of the diagnostics that you see today are a result of infrastructure that was put in place because of COVID. But I think also the massive difference that you see in behavior right now is because of COVID. We're all a lot more accustomed to getting tested. We're also a lot more now in tune with how necessary it is to maintain, if you like, an elevated baseline of underlying health. So the first version was genuinely embarrassing. We would send you your results sending the results in a PDF, I don't think it's a terrible experience, right? But actually, when you came then to see the results into your account, to act, to do something about them, we're just very far from where we needed to be. Now you have a dedicated mobile app that you can see trends over time. You can see information. You can request a consultation and more information. And you can see the history of the different blood tests that you've taken. And very soon you'll be able to start connecting them also with the treatments that you engage with Numan. So still ways to go. I think it's that area is becoming a lot more interesting, both in the breadth of diagnostics and screening that you can do, but also the depth of that experience. But at least now we do have a much better platform to build from than when we're getting started.
You mentioned in the beginning doing a bigger fundraising from the very early on. Why was that a choice? And also, how do you approach fundraising for first-time founders? How was your approach? What did you try to convey early on?
So first of all, I set my goals on actually raising a bigger amount because the market that we're in, or what we needed to build and where we would need to take the business for the next milestone, needed that money. I also was a lot more comfortable with being uncomfortable or being unclear and unsure about what it is that aspects of the plan, right? Because obviously when you're starting, you have nothing. You will have things that you don't know. Otherwise, you're being naive about what it is that you're trying to do. And you need to have the capital that will give you the time to make mistakes and understand things and take risks. Obviously, there's a balance between those things. We didn't do anything crazy. And when I say crazy, some of the raising too much at too high valuation before you've proven nothing comes with a whole bunch of risk attached to it. So you need to find the right balance between raising enough that you can recruit good people, you can spend some money on testing propositions, you can put some money behind marketing, and that when you add it all up, it comes to a figure that is in the low millions. And that kind of should be enough to get you going. And I was very comfortable to say that we're going to get things wrong, we're going to make mistakes. That's the things that we're clear about, and we need to raise this amount of money, and we need to be able to not give more than this percentage of the business so that we don't really hamper our ability to raise follow-on funding. Because the business that we're in and the space that we're in, we knew from the start you would need to go and reach scale and do it quickly. This is, by the way, by no means the right way, the only way. That stuff doesn't matter, right? You absolutely don't have to raise money to go after and execute what it is that you want to execute. Or you may want to raise a lot more money than I did to get going. It entirely depends on you, what you want to build, and where you want to take the business. And the difference between now and the first time I raised money, actually, I don't know, the first time I raised money, I really knew absolutely nothing. When I say nothing, I found the original deck that we had done with my co-founder at the time, and it is just so innocent, and it's probably something that kids at school do now as part of the kind of classes that they do when they're 13 years old or something like that. It was 2005, 2006 when we put that together. So you can imagine what that was like. And I was very paranoid about raising money. I was very paranoid about these people that would come into my business. I was completely like horrified about some of the terms that I would start discussing with investors. I really didn't understand concepts like reverse vesting or vesting on its own, or what it means to be a good lever, bad lever, a lot of those things that come with when you're dealing with more sophisticated investors. But the thing that we did do really well as first-time founders back then, because we didn't know any better, we had a complete lack of any fear or any inhibition, and we had an absolute just mountains of energy to be out pretty much every night or every other night to every single event that was happening in London where we'd go and speak to people. And actually, that's how we met. Our first investor was somebody that I worked for in my first job as a graduate. Then my first job was at Vodafone. I did an internship for the CTO of Vodafone at the time for 6 months. And after I had left, I joined another startup. And about 2 years after that, I called him up and I went to see him and I pitched him and he invested because, I don't know, he liked us and he believed in us. And then the first more institutional money that we raised was my co-founder just was queuing up in one of those events to speak to somebody, started the conversation with another person that was there. And that ended up being Hugo Burge that led our first £500,000 investment into my first business, Trusted Places. I guess energy and maximizing the opportunity that you're going to have when you have no network is a thing to really focus on as a first-time founder. As a repeat entrepreneur, you have a very different network to lean on and work with. So you can be a lot more targeted, a lot more effective.
I also saw, you mentioned distribution, doing distribution very differently. I've seen the most original ads and approach for Numan until today. How did you approach the advertising or maybe the distribution from the beginning, like early days versus today in your approach?
So we started, by the way, distribution and growth and acquisition and marketing weren't the areas I gravitated naturally towards. I come from an engineering background. I'm more focused on product, on the concepts, on the user. That's the stuff that it's a bit more on my comfort zone. But again, from first principles, when you're starting, obviously, even though we had raised money, we were very resource constrained and we could only do things that were, I spoke to a bunch of people that were a lot more experts than I was at the time. And what I got back just didn't make sense to me. It was very diluted. It was, let's try a whole bunch of different things and see what might work, which I couldn't really understand the mechanics and the numbers behind that. When you have a limited amount of capital to deploy in distribution, you have to find the one channel that kind of works. You need to start with a tried and tested things where people are, i.e. search and performance. You need to figure out, and there's only a limited amount of channels that you can start with. You need to start getting some momentum, and then you need to look at your entire funnel and optimize it and know that the place that you're going to start will be very different from where you're going to be in 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, a year, because you're going to keep learning, keep improving, keep iterating, right? So it doesn't make sense to go with a big above-the-line campaign when you launch and your product hasn't been tested by real people at scale, because your conversion will be significant. If your conversion is at, if you like, the ceiling of where naturally it's going to be, you've launched way too late, right? It's impossible to get to that point. So by definition, the place you're going to start is going to be severely suboptimal. So at that point, you need to be frugal, you need to be testing, and you need to work through that and figure it out, which is, by the way, it's not a cheap exercise. You can't really scale those things right now. You can't figure out what your paid search or your paid social strategy is going to be without having some real money to spend behind that. Maybe again, your product lends itself fantastically to PR. You can build, you can create a category, you can have some kind of unique edge that the market doesn't have, in which case, and you should try to find that, by the way. Fantastic. If you can do that, if you have like unique IP that you're building on, if you have a product that hasn't been seen ever before, if you happen to be Elon Musk, funny aside, I was speaking to the ex-CEO of a massive FMCG business, publicly listed business, and his advice to me at the time was get the basics really absolutely best in class. And then he used the example of Elon Musk as somebody that does all the work for Tesla so that they don't have to spend any money on marketing and distribution. That's quite a difficult strategy to try to replicate, unless, again, you are really prepared to be very visible, very controversial, and also have some traits that let you do that, right? I didn't pretend that I had those, so we had to settle for things that are a little bit more in our control. So anyway, that's where you start. But then quickly, we wanted to be non-reliant on a single channel or performance auction-based channels. And we explored above the line and we explored TV. And again, we took an approach there that was iterative. We started very humbly, very simply, very cheaply. We iterated a few times and we started getting traction and learning and uncovering a little bit more about how that world works. We got a bit lucky, and that's how we started scaling the business.
Can we speak a bit more about TV, I think, especially in the tech world? I don't know many companies that use it, but I've seen that your approach was very different approach, a very original type of advertisement. What are the learnings? What did you do the first time? What are you doing now? What are the learnings and maybe the transition of the things that work?
Sure. Again, this depends really on what it is that you're doing. If you are building a SaaS product to optimize part of a business's unique processes, probably it's going to be difficult to go on TV and make it work. Mm-hmm. For us, TV was relevant for a number of reasons. A, it added credibility and trust into what we're doing. Automatically, when you see a brand show up in a place that you associate with businesses that have earned the right to be there, you'll take a different view whether you're going to trust them with something that is requires to have that level of trust. After that, because of a lot of what we wanted to do involved awareness in an audience that we knew was had a problem, because you have the statistics of the people that have the problem but wasn't actually acting on it, we wanted to create awareness to capture their attention. And then when we did that, you need to figure out how you're going to do that and what's the message that you're going to go with and how you're going to evolve that. Again, when you're starting up, there are certain kind of places you can go on TV that are simpler and cheaper. You cannot be, I think, too smart about it. You have to be very clear, very to the point. If you think about a really high-end, abstract, very brand-led comms campaign that is perhaps a little bit obscure about what the product does or what it is there to do, if you go with that approach, which is quite easy to do if you let your ego or your preconceptions dictate your decisions, you are likely to fail. When you're starting out, you need to be quite clear, quite distinct. You need to be doing selling and you need to go with a message that's going to be really well understood and it's going to convert. And that's where you're going to start. You do need to have certain necessary ingredients, right? So this idea of distinctive brand assets, again, a lot of people are trying to think about how they need to be different, how they're going to be unique, how they're going to be, perhaps have certain attributes of the brand that they believe are the ones that they should have. The main thing that you need to do is you need to be distinctive so that people will remember you. You need to create relevant memory associations with what it is you're trying to do and the message that you're going to try to convey. And then you need to use creativity to capture people's attention. And that's how we evolved our strategy. We started with a very simple 30-second advert that said exactly what we did. We evolved to something that was a lot more provocative and attention grabbing. And then after that, we graduated to a world that we have now that is, again, quite distinctive and very different than what the category actually typically does. But aesthetically, it's a lot more kind of cohesive. It's a bit of, it lets us build different narratives, and it serves as a kind of communication platform for everything that we want to do as Neumann, which is not the original categories that we started with, but it is a ecosystem around your health for a number of conditions with a number of products.
How do you measure these things? Is it that direct sales, for example, the moment that an advertisement is happening, or are there different ways of measuring?
You won't see the sales immediately, typically with TV, but you will, especially if you do it early on. Your attribution is fairly simple because you will be able to see the fluctuations that you're going to have in your traffic according against your typical baseline. You can measure response times fairly accurately because you can track when your media is shown and what happens. But then you need to be able to figure out how that actually translates in conversions in revenue across a period of time. And as you scale, that becomes a little bit more complex. In fact, it becomes a lot more complex. You need to build your own view of the world. How are you going to do your attribution? What kind of econometric model are you going to create? How are you going to use data science around all the data you have collected at that point? And that will get you some of the answer. It won't give you the whole answer. But you can refer to your own data over a period of time. You can supplement that with different surveys, different ways that you can actually ask your audience. You can refer to research that's been done before. But I think a lot of those things, you need to also apply that kind of logic test and that first principles, like think it through if it really makes sense and if it adds up. Go back to your data and then build your own tools to be able to figure out what that will tell you. It is not a simple exercise, but if you're going to build something that has a big consumer appeal, I think it is hard to not have it as part of your mix, especially if you're going to try to follow a strategy that is a little bit more robust, i.e. you're not depending on what policy is going to change in X platform that you're using, and a bit more scalable, and will also let you deploy spend in ways that are perhaps non-linear. And above the line lets you do that quite effectively.
Very interesting. If we get back into the proposition now, how do you evolve from here onwards? What are the plans?
So if you think about the journey that we've been through and that where we started from, right? And where we started from, better than I do, the challenges with infrastructure and accessibility and interoperability when it comes to health, we had to build pretty much everything by ourselves. But sorry, looking back up, we didn't have to, because you could execute the model of what we're doing by stitching together different platforms and different components, and you could get going quickly. But you would have found it impossible, I believe, to scale beyond a certain level. And you would have also found it impossible to really make the economics work. So with Neumann, in our third year of operations, we acquired our pharmacy partner. So we started integrating, becoming a much more integrated group that really owned the entire user experience. From a very early on, from pretty much the inception of the business, we registered to become a healthcare provider to be regulated by the Care Quality Commission, which is the regulator that oversees the delivery of care in England and in Wales, because we believe that you needed to own those parts of the experience, to deliver the experience that you want, to understand it deep enough, but also to make the economics and the margin profile of the business that you're building work. So we started, and again, the promise and the proposition to the patient at the time was safe and accessible access to medication that can help you alleviate symptoms of a certain problem that you have. We layered on top of that diagnostics so that you can understand your underlying health better as a whole, but also specifically to the areas that we can help you with. And most recently, we started adding the kind of different journeys, with obesity being, if you like, the initial wedge in that, where we will give you medication that will deliver results for you over a longer period of time. It won't be an instant erectile dysfunction, you know, I want better erections, I take a pill, I see the result. It won't be also as simple as hair loss in terms of the kind of the product that you're getting. With medication around obesity, you need to understand the starting point, and then you need to evolve the patient on a journey that has like a personalized titration program for that patient, which means that the way that you find medication success is very different. And the way that you engage the patient through that journey is also a lot more sophisticated than just sending them a medication through their letterbox every month or every 3 months. But with weight, we don't just stop at giving you the medication. We also, again, onboard you on the mobile app that has dedicated content that can educate you and help you understand nutrition, mindset, sleep, and exercise. And it will connect you also with a team of coaches that are there to support you along the journey, either as accountability partners or experts that can provide specific plans, action points, and support as and when you need it. We're adding after that diagnostics that are relevant to your metabolic kind of health and what that looks like. And that's when you start seeing that original vision that I've talked about just come together in one place. The way we apply that and the platform that we've built to deliver that experience, we're not looking to expand it into other areas of health that are quite relevant to what we do. And we see a huge opportunity to serve. We've now served 500,000 patients in the UK alone. And we see a massive opportunity to actually scale from this point with the brand recognition, with the infrastructure and the momentum that we have to really have impact into millions of patients here across a number of conditions. And then after that, still there are billions of people globally that deserve better access to health. And the way to deliver that is through technology. And that's what we're excited about. We're in our sixth year now. That may take at least another six or probably a lot longer than that. But that was also one of the reasons why I was excited about building this company and committing to building this company, because you can stay energized by the problems that you're solving for quite a long time.
Mentioned mobile and insights. I think there are so many companies trying to solve this appropriately now. What is your take in terms of educating the customer? And is there a better way of doing this over time?
So this is what I fundamentally believe is that the number one, if you like, the mistake that we often make as a entrepreneurs or people that product people, brand people, when you work on the inside is what I've just talked about. This sounds exciting. This is how I approach my health. And this is what I'm really excited about. You need to find out what people really want right now and what is that most important kind of first step for them. And for a lot of people, what I just described, that's exactly what they want. They want to take a very different view to their health holistically. And they want something that is can be personalized to them at the price point that is they're prepared to pay, with an experience that they're prepared to engage with. For a lot of people, they're coming on a journey towards that. They're still very much have a specific pain point. They need a specific solution. And the most important thing for them is ease. They want something that is at the kind of the least amount of effort and a maximum amount of results. And that is universally true, right? But I also believe what I was saying earlier, we are seeing an increased amount of people that their behavior to health is changing drastically. If you think about the way that we're now, where we're spending money, both in people more around my generation, but also people that are a lot younger that are engaging now, they're actually spending money on whether it is fitness, whether it is wellness, whether it is health, they display very different attitudes, desires, and behaviors, and spending behaviors as well. So I think we're getting into a point, and of course, what you do with Terra and how you see also that proliferation of understanding the impact that a number of different factors have on health outcomes, but also on everyday, if you like, performance, energy, vitality, all of those things. And those proliferations of interconnected technologies, I think, completely transform the landscape of what health is now and where it is going to be in the next 5 years, where you're going to have genuinely relevant, personalized insights, but then the infrastructure to deliver the right kind of intervention to do something about those insights. And that's the exciting.
Awesome. I like this question that I took from one of the previous podcasts. If we go 100 years into the future and we look backwards at healthcare, what things are we going to say that we're really stupid about in terms of how we're considering them today?
That's amazing. It's such a great question. Look, a big one is nutrition, right? Nutrition is one of the areas where we're flying blind in a lot of cases, and that's changing a lot. You had George from Zoe on the podcast before, who's a great friend, who's doing something to really change that. But I think also the approach that we take to health and the way that we practice medicine, we will look back at it and be amazed at how reactive we are right now when it comes to health. We spend 98% of the spend in this country, in the UK, spent on cure rather than prevention of disease. And also the view that we take on risk. This is something that is, for me, blows my mind, again, when it comes to that cardiovascular risk, where great doctors are making decisions with guidelines that are looking at your 10-year risk horizon. As I was saying earlier, right? Oh, you don't smoke, you exercise, you don't drink, you do this and what. You don't need to worry about any risk for the next 10 years when it comes to your cardiovascular health. So we're going from this system of health that optimizes at the population level to a place where we're going to genuinely be able to maximize for the individual. And I think that's going to be the big transition, but I hope we'll be able to see that a lot sooner rather than the next 100 years.
Great. Socrates, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Kyriakos, it has been indeed. Thank you. Cheers.